huge news, years in the making, my brand new book that my publishers refuse to publish, Money Matrix. Beat the money system and build generational wealth. Understand the three main ways that the banks productize you and make money from you. You'll be able to turn that system against itself, build generational wealth and multiple streams of recurring income. It's all at moneymatrix.cash. And if you're quick, the first few hundred registrants and buyers will receive many special bonuses from me. The brand new Moneymaker Summit 3-day special event. Meet me at a champagne reception. Meet me at a multi-millionaire networking dinner. Go now, moneymatrix.cash. This is huge.
The opportunity to leverage a lot and do a lot is there if my mindset felt more comfortable with it.
Ebony, is the gender pay gap real? Is it a thing?
Of course it's real. There's no doubt generationally where women have been in history that there's an issue around finance and funding for women, and historically women have got less. However, from my perspective as well, being a woman who hasn't had children, who stayed in the working game longer, and there's a lot of stats around this, if you're in the game in those ages, 30 to 40, actually the gap significantly shuts. So I think women are disadvantaged when they end up sometimes having to come out of work, and also with the historical problem. So yes, it's real. It varies for different people depending on life circumstances, but it's something that is improving.
Because I thought it'd be fun to have a look at the top OnlyFans earners.
There ain't no men making
money on OnlyFans.
Yeah.
I think Blac Chyna does 21 million a month.
Yeah.
So it's 250 million a year. Top 10, by the way, I want to talk about it because I said to you before, I've never actually talked about this in 1,000-odd episodes. I haven't talked about this. But I guess my point is all the top OnlyFans are women because clearly there's more value to men to consume that content. Mm. So is it that in some industries or areas, women have more value and in others, men have more value or are paid more depending on industry or area?
I like where you've gone with it. There's a few things I thought. So one, social media, I think, has changed the game full stop because it's just removed any barrier or hierarchy of someone in a position of power being able to tell you what you can do. So if a woman sets up her OnlyFans, if she's attractive, it will help. There's no doubt about that. But, you know, if a woman sets up something which is not determined by somebody else deciding where or where they can't get in it, they have freedom.
Right.
And so I do think that in the modern generation, there are way more opportunities to break that, which didn't exist in old school. It didn't exist in male-dominated environments of sport, for example, where I've come from. So I think you're right.
Because again, like, look at Instagram. Kim Kardashian, she'd get a million a post. So what I think, are you saying we've got this decentralization where you've got control of your own brand, you've got control of your own media on social media, and therefore that's created a more fair playing field?
Yeah, because then it's down to the public or the people consuming your content to decide, are you good enough? Are you what I want to consume? What is your messaging? And do I buy into you? You are not.
And what do you look like naked?
Well, I don't go on OnlyFans.
I'm waiting for your OnlyFans.
That is not me. You need to get on OnlyFans and get going. But
the money was right.
If the money was right, we don't we'll have to talk about that. How do you make money in 2022? Well, you can show us. But no, I think there are genuine issues though in society, and I think it depends on the environment you're in. There's no doubt, like you say, certain environments now women can make as much, way more, and capitalize. But the truth is there are a lot of women who are in very different industries which have layers and layers and layers of history associated to it. Then you take in having babies or life that takes you out the game, certain parts of it, and you are hamstrung. So for me, I think it depends on what environment you are. I think the good news, though, if I had a young kid coming through or a young person, I'd be saying, get in the train where you're not limited by what someone else thinks of you. You can create as much as you can for yourself.
I mean, there's a lot more women commentators on Sky now, isn't there? It's become more balanced. Is the pay gap fair there?
It is. Yeah. I think it's an interesting one because when I got into the commentary game 10 years ago, there weren't many women. There was one before me and Isha Gua who both came into cricket. And it was just a very different environment. What I think was really interesting for us is I think society started demanding more. There'd been Me Too movements around gender pay gap. And so there was a lot more pressure on, I think, the sport industries, the media, to make sure people are represented and reflected in sport that they watch. And so for me personally, I got lucky. I came out at a time where that movement was happening. And I was fortunate enough to jump on a train. There are women maybe 10 years before who had just as much or more talent, wouldn't have been able to either get into the industry or wouldn't have been possibly paid fairly. So I'm in a golden time in generation where, you know, I think when you do get that opportunity, you've got to make the most of it.
So you played cricket for England.
Mm.
It's really good that you're grateful that you think the timing is good for you. But could you have said from the actual sport career, you were just a bit late? Because now there's, you know, you've got the 100 and there's the women and then the men, and I love that, and it makes it a spectacle and a full day. So yeah, did you play late with your batting, and have you played late with when you were born?
I missed one just outside the off stump. Yeah. Is basically what happened. And it's really interesting because I retired 2010-ish, so we just won World Cup, World T20, and Ashes, and that in cricket is like the gold standard. Yeah. But it was kind of known a little bit, kind of not. And actually, an interesting analogy around sort of gender was the men won the Ashes that summer. We won all of those three trophies that year, both on sports personality.
In 2005?
Yeah, so 2009 it was. Both went up for sports team of the year. And the men won. And I remember thinking, hold on, what does the women have to do? This is possibly the greatest team in history. But we weren't recognised at that time, right? So I think it was still a reflection of women's sport still had a long way to go. But about 2 years after, so I retired around then, 2 years later, the money came in the game. The contract started to come. I was calling up my players who I retired from, and they're like, yeah, got the car, got the sunglasses, got the contract, and it was starting to flow in. Money was starting to flow in. Mm. If I started now, capitalise, there's no doubt, financially. But then saying that, there's also way more competition. More people want it. More people working harder. I'd have had to up my game. But I most probably missed out, I think, 5 years if I would have either continued to play a bit longer or came into the game 5 years later, I would have been on this new crest of a wave.
Yeah. Interesting you're talking about money, because a lot of people...
I want to ask you about money.
All right, well, I'll ask you one more. So a lot of people think that a lot of money in sport, it's a bit grotesque, but what you've just said, more money in the women's game, more competition, more talent coming through. So what are your thoughts on the amount of money in sport?
It's a really interesting one, isn't it? Because sometimes you can get criticised if you don't just say women should be paid equally to what the men and the women make. And
do you think they should be paid equally?
Well, I think we're going in the right direction. I think we need quicker change, but I also understand from working behind the scenes sometimes the commercial elements that go with it. So you look at the men and women's 100, for example. The top men's players are 100 and odd K. I think it's 125. The top women are more like 30 to 50, I think it is. So there is a big disparity.
Is that also not linked to who pulls the crowds, who pulls the sponsorships and the brands?
Well, so this is what I was going to say is, so if you just explicitly say men and women should be paid the same, and if you don't say that, especially as a woman, it can come across wrong. I think what is important is that gap closes quickly. And what we saw with, say, for example, the 100 now, when men and women's game played side by side, the crowds were coming in for the women, and they're now justifying the investment, which makes you go, you got to pay them more because the crowds are turning up, the families are turning up. The standard and performance is through the game. So I think there's a bit of a cycle. And the problem is sometimes the people who held the position of power of putting it on our TV screens or investing in it to get that cycle working. Sometimes in the past, it was hampered. And I think once people start to invest, you see that cycle just improve, goes on broadcast, standards improve, you build an audience comes through, and you get a product that then deserves to be paid equally. So I think we're getting there, and the change that I think we've seen in the last 5 years is outstanding.
Yeah.
Money, anyway, I want to talk to
you about
money.
Let's talk about money, my favourite subject.
Yeah, well, I know you because I got in touch years ago, wasn't it, about my old podcast.
Yeah.
And you came on, actually. You didn't know who I was, but I knew you liked a bit of cricket and you were good. And I loved your content because, let's be honest, I want to live a good life, I want to make good money, you know, invest in property, etc. So I'm thinking about the average Joe at the moment, looking at the world and money going, we're possibly going into a recession, inflation issues, we're coming out the back of a pandemic, all this sort of stuff. So I hear a lot of doom and gloom about money, But then I want to know how someone like you right now in these conditions are viewing money and wealth. Is this when you think the wealthy get rich, or is it doom and gloom?
Well, there are more millionaires made in recessions than any other time in the cycle. If you look at the really rich people and the big companies that were built, they're often built on a recession. Mm-hmm. And what a recession, there's a few things to this answer, and I need to take you through them all. So the first thing is you need to understand what a recession is. Mm-hmm. A recession is 3 quarters in a row of negative economic growth. Mm-hmm. There, other people will have other definitions of that. So you could have GDP contraction of 0.1% 3 quarters in a row. So in 9 months, 0.3% reduction in GDP, overall velocity of money, and we're in a recession. Mm. But 0.3% of trillions of pounds running through the economy, it's not really much. Mm. So I always say to people, there's the economy and there's your economy.
Okay.
So the economy is the gross domestic product, GDP. It is the amount, the velocity of money, which is the total amount of money and the amount of transactions and the flow of that money. But your economy is your own flow. Mm. Why can't you build your wealth in a recession? Mm. Just because there's a recession doesn't mean you have a recession. So I told you about OnlyFans. Mm-hmm. I mean, we interviewed a winner of Love Island on the show. And she, at 20 years old, was a stripper. Mm-hmm. And she was making quite good money, $5,000 a week, I think she said, for 4 days, pretty good money. Got onto OnlyFans doing the same thing, but not have to be in the presence of men, touching her, you know, spilling beer all over her, being men. Yeah, exactly. So instead of it 1-to-1, it's 1-to-5,000. So it's scalable. You can do it in your home with a little bit of equipment. Mm. She makes millions on OnlyFans, doing the same thing online that she did, making $5,000 a week. Mm. So, for example, people would say, well, the lockdown was really bad. The lockdown was brilliant for people on OnlyFans because all men, well, not all men, but a lot of men
were on it.
I mean, I even thought about signing up to an OnlyFans. I haven't signed up to an OnlyFans.
I'm glad you didn't.
My wife has access to all my bank accounts. She knows what OnlyFans is. I've never signed up to an OnlyFans. Just want to make that clear. But, you know, I can understand why men, when they've got nothing to do, when they're lonely and blah, blah, blah. So she has seen an opportunity and taken it. I don't know whether you agree with taking your clothes off for money. I'll park that. That's not the point. But Amazon boomed in lockdown. Zoom boomed in lockdown. All these individual creators setting up Patreons. And, you know, doing online courses and membership sites, they all boomed in lockdown. So you either see a recession as a downside or an upside opportunity. Mm-hmm. If you've got a town and it's full of buildings and then the town gets blown to pieces and all the buildings get wiped out, you've got a whole new flat piece of land to build a new city on. And what recessions do is correct. So if you think about shops, retail, money is moving away from them. Money is moving away from some men to some women in the commentary world. Mm-hmm. And with this equality, some men have been cancelled and some women are coming through the ranks. So the point is, there's always opportunity if you see it. But
well, that's the point, though. You just said if you see it. And so I've followed your journey, for example. I think you became a millionaire by 30, but at 25.
31. I was really pissed off because I wanted to be by 30.
And you missed it by a little bit.
Months.
But you'll take it. Yeah. But at 25, I think it was, you weren't quite there, right? So to take advantage of this new, whether it's the recession or the opportunities, you have your brain has to be right. So the question is, how do you go from, say, where you were 25 or 21 to where you were at 30. What is the flip that when the recession comes or when opportunities come, you see it and you capitalize?
Yeah, well, the first thing is you've got to want to be successful, be wealthy, or be valuable. Mm. And when I was 25, I thought I did, but inside I didn't really want to be wealthy or successful or valuable. The next thing is you have to be prepared to change what isn't working. Mm. So why aren't you wealthy, successful, or valuable? Mm. And you have to be honest, because to look in the mirror and go, something ain't working here. It's easy to go, oh, look at you in your Ferrari. Mm. You must be a drug dealer. Oh, the media, the scammers in government, the tax is too high. Mm-hmm. My boss isn't fair. He's not paying me more money. It's easy to blame everyone else. But Harry and I were talking about this on the way down. I believe that you are paid what you are worth, mm-hmm. as perceived by society. And if you want to get paid more, you either have to change society, and this is what's happening with the gender pay gap mm-hmm. closing in, for example, sport. Society is changing. Mm-hmm. Or you have to change yourself. Mm-hmm. It's hard to change society. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Really hard, unless you're the prime minister mm-hmm. or something. Much easier to change yourself. But to change yourself, you kind of got to go, yeah, what I was doing wasn't working. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I messed that up. I was a bit of a loser, you know, blah, blah, blah. I had the blame mentality. And that either happens because you want it mm-hmm. or something happens that shocks you.
Okay.
So many people go through life being just comfortable enough. Mm-hmm. You know, they're in a job that they don't quite hate enough to leave mm-hmm. and they're paid just enough to stay.
They're just cushy zone.
Yeah, that little zone. But it's not quite cushy. It's a bit lower than cushy. Mm. It's like, I don't hate it enough to leave and I'm paid just enough to stay. Mm-hmm. That's a bit of a trap, really. Mm. But you have to look at yourself and go, what haven't I done well? What's wrong with my mentality? Mm-hmm. And how can I change? Mm-hmm. And to change, you have to be honest about what you've accepted and what you believe. And then you have to go and find out what information you don't have. Mm. So the reason I wrote my book, Money, was because there's so much information in the world about money that most people don't have. Mm. And by the way, it's often not your fault. Mm. You can't help how you were raised, where you were raised, what country you were born in. You can't help that. But if you've got access to the internet mm. or you can get on Amazon or Audible or podcasts or lives, you now can change what mm. didn't work. And so you either want change enough or something happens and you're like, fuck my life. Mm. So I had a fuck my life moment where my dad had a massive nervous breakdown in mm. his pub had a big meltdown. He got beaten up by the police. He got diagnosed with bipolar. He got sectioned.
Wow.
And I had to blame myself. I couldn't blame anyone else. So dad had put me through private school, university, bought my first car, bought my first house, all helped me. And I'm 26, still living in the pub, still working in the pub, earning 200 quid, spending 300 quid, hating my job, but paid just enough to stay and not hating it just enough to leave, still relying on my parents, age nearly fucking 26. And I didn't have the courage to be honest enough to take responsibility, so I blamed everyone else. Mm. Society, you know, blah, blah, blah. It's not fair. And then when that happened to my dad, I could only blame myself because people have said, no, you can't blame yourself. That was your dad. But I could blame myself for where I was at because I was shown enough pain. Mm. And then everything changed from there. And three years later, I was a millionaire. Another sort of 6-7 years later, I was a multimillionaire. I got to the point where I could, at 10 million net worth, I think you can stop counting, because at 10 million, a million's not a lot of money anymore. Mm. It's not. You take 50% off tax,
yep.
Inflation, blah, blah, blah. It's not a lot of money anymore.
Away, yeah.
But 10 million's enough for most people to live a good life. If mm-hmm. you're, even if you're 30, you could probably retire on 10 million. So mm. I sort of stopped counting.
All right, I'm ticking that one.
Around
now.
About the
10, ten, yeah? Yeah. 10, all right, I need to up my game.
That's the new million. That's the new million is 10, 10 million.
Okay.
Yeah. And so I had something external happen to me that forced me to change and look and really reflect about what I didn't know. The great thing about money, business, entrepreneurship is the more you learn, the more you earn. Mm. And you can be in a corporate role, and the more you learn makes fuck all difference, because mm. you're in your job, and 5 years you might get a promotion.
If you're lucky.
Yeah, if you're lucky. Whereas when you're an entrepreneur, the more you learn, the more you earn. So I started to invest in myself because I realized I was the best asset.
Mm. You also have more to lose, though.
Well, I was talking to my housekeeper and she just was talking to me a bit about how she's struggling with a couple of financial things. Mm-hmm. And I said to her, my friend just got tied up in his own house, his children live in his house, and burgled and beaten up for his expensive watches. And people don't realise when you're rich, you just have different problems. Yeah. Now, I don't ever going around saying, oh, my life is so hard because I'm really rich, because most of society wouldn't understand. So I don't say it unless I'm directly asked. But, you know, when I was broke, I had different problems. Mm. Now that I'm rich, I just have bigger problems. Now, I don't have problems of travel and luxury and self-worth as much, because net worth does increase your self-worth. But I have problems of security and insurance. Mm. My cars are fucking expensive. And when they break down, it's fucking expensive. Mm. $5,000 for a wing mirror on my Lamborghini.
What did you bang into?
My own garage. But yeah, you know, you get trolled, you get a lot of online hate, you know, half of society hate you. So I don't want people to think, people want to get wealthy because they think their problems will go away. Mm. Your problems never go away. You just get different problems. But if you're grateful for better quality problems, so I look at some of the problems I've got now and I think, yeah, they're better quality problems. I've got a client who she's always juggling money around and she's always needing to raise money and she always pulls it out at the last minute and she gets a bit stressed and upset and then she pulls it out of the bag and she raises a load of money. And she just got some really freaking awful news. And she said, Rob, I wish I had my old problems back.
Because she's been through it.
Because she's now got a bigger problem. I can't say what it is because it's confidential. But yeah, with what is it? Mo money, mo problems. Mm. I think that's what they say.
Well, a question I do have for you. This is definitely one I'm keen on knowing what you think about. So obviously you're a property man. I think last I read was like over 700 properties. Who knows you got?
1,250
tenants. Well, okay. So it's ramped up a bit. Yeah. So you're doing all right. A new assets about crypto, digital asset. I'm getting in the Bitcoin, Ethereum, Matic. I'm getting in the game. I want to know what you think about it, just generally. Is it the future? Is it a hedge against inflation? And two, are you still hunkering down on the old school type of asset? Would you still bank property all day, or would you see this as something you add to your portfolio? What do you think?
Okay, so the first thing about crypto is there's two types. Mm. There's Bitcoin and everything else.
Yeah.
And people don't get that. Bitcoin looks like it's proven to be fully decentralized. Mm-hmm. Finite supply. No one entrepreneur or business person owns the platform. Mm-hmm. Completely decentralized. I have not found another crypto platform which is fully decentralized. Mm-hmm. So some of them, they make out that they are, but they're owned by someone or a platform. Well, what if that platform goes under or they go bust? Mm-hmm. It's gone. Mm-hmm. Because I actually launched my own set of NFTs and I was looking at how I could make them fully decentralized. You can't. Mm. That's your risk. So I think Bitcoin is probably here to stay because it's probably gone through the initial round of stress testing. And I think right now it's probably priced relatively low compared to where it's been. If you're going to put money into Bitcoin, I recommend you put money in that you can afford to lose, which is called risk capital, money you can afford to risk, and hold it for as long as you can. Because the problem when you trade anything, stocks, shares, cryptos, property, you have taxes, buying and selling costs. So every time you're moving that big cake, you're taking slices out of it. The longer you hold it, the more it appreciates and you haven't got all these slices taken off in fees and taxes and everything else. So trade it. The next thing you need to think about, so there's Bitcoin and everything else, and then there's investing or trading. Mm-hmm. I'm not a trader because time in the market's really freaking difficult. I reckon there's 0.0001% of people who know how to do that. Mm-hmm. But over the long term, even most average assets that beat inflation, you're going to win on. Mm-hmm. So you said then, so if you're going to do these other things, XRP people talk a lot about on my lives.
Matic, Polygon.
Yeah, there's a load of them. Mm. Ripple. They're all a bit different, but I see them at another level of risk as I do Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. So let's say you're going to look at an investment portfolio. Mm-hmm. I would probably say 5% is okay for Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. I'd probably say 1% is okay for all the others. Okay. That would be my personal view. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, if you've got a grand, it's a bit different. You might have to go to 20%. Mm-hmm. But unless you really understand it more than anyone else. So then your second part of your question is, are you still into the old school stuff like property? Yeah. The thing with Bitcoin and all the other cryptos is we don't fucking need them. Like if they all went, like if NFTs went, oh, I lost a picture. Yeah. Fuck. You know, we don't actually need them.
Yeah.
We need property because we need somewhere to live. And if we lost houses, we're all living in tents. Mm. So things like gold.
Yeah.
Gold is, it's not as useful as property, but it's still useful. It's an actual hard asset, mm-hmm. whereas cash money is not a hard asset. So property you need. Mm-hmm. It has utility, number one. And it has scarcity. Now, Bitcoin's figured out the scarcity bit, but a lot of the other cryptos haven't. They can just quantitative ease them like you do with cash. So everyone needs somewhere to live. Mm-hmm. So property has utility. And we don't have much more land we can build on in the UK. Well, we have land, but you can't, the planning won't let you, you build on it. So you have this growing population of people, but you can't grow the housing building.
So then it's still in scarcity.
So you've got more supply than demand. And when you have more supply than demand, you have price increases generally, which is what you've seen with watches. One of the reasons secondhand cars have gone up so much is because you can't get new cars. So there's a scarcity of new cars, so it pushes the value of secondhand cars up, supply and demand. So in 1952, the average property was £1,800. Now it's approaching £250,000. Mm-hmm. That's fucking history. Mm. So yeah, cryptos and Bitcoin, all great, but there's no history. But with property, in fact, all land and property, according to the Doomsday Book in 1088, was about £1 million in the UK. Mm-hmm. Now you can't get a 100 metre square flat in London. You can't get, in some places you can't get a garage for £1 million in central. So it shows you what's done to prices. So if you're going to invest, you should take a larger percentage of your portfolio on proven assets that beat inflation, that go up over time. I believe you should buy, hold, die.
Yeah.
A lot of people are trading. Oh, I'm just going to sell my property now and take some money out. But they've got 10% in selling costs. They get haggled a bit. They've got the taxes. And they're actually left with not a lot more. And then what are they going to do with the rest of that money? Then they're going to spend it. Whereas if you leave it in property, it doubles every 10 to 15 years. It does. I was buying properties for 60 and 70 grand that are now worth £250,000. Wow. Just little properties. And that's over 15 years.
Yeah.
So safe, secure, proven, long-term, buy, hold, die for maybe 70% of your portfolio. And then you can look at all the other stuff. People also have to understand the difference between capital and income, and they don't. So
break that down for me.
Bitcoin is a capital asset.
Yeah.
It does not produce an income stream.
Yeah, as in cash flow, basically. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
So people, you know, gold's great, but it doesn't produce a cash flow. Rolex Daytonas are great, but they don't produce a cash produce cash flow. Some old school Ferraris are great, but they don't produce a cash flow, and they have maintenance and management. You've got to store and insure gold, blah, blah, blah. You've got to make sure you don't lose your wallet and your key for Bitcoin. So you got, it's capital, not income. But property is income. And it's also capital. It doubles every 10 to 15 years.
And you get,
and you get rental income.
And last one, last two things is cash, so cash is dead. Are you putting all your money that you have spent into as many assets as possible? Because cash and inflation and all those issues. And then the last question, debt. Debt to leverage to still get property is still the best way, do you believe?
Yeah. So, cash is not dead, but it's on life support.
Yeah.
Cash got into a coma in 1971. So in August 1971, Nixon took the dollar off the gold standard. Well, he created fiat currency. There was no gold standard backing money. And that meant that money as we knew it started to decline in value. And it declined with inflation. Now, when inflation is 1 and 2%, you don't feel it. You don't feel that on your spending, really. But when inflation is 7, 8, 12, 15... By the way, when you're told it's 7, it's not. It's more.
It's always more. Yeah.
Because let me ask you this. Has your milk gone up 7% in the last year?
Everything is going up.
Has your eggs gone up 7%? Exactly.
Everything's up.
By a long way. Not just... They can say inflation is 7%. You just got to look at everything that you're buying.
Yeah.
It's obvious. Exactly. So money has... The thing with fiat currency, money, which is essentially a tool created to better exchange value, it's an amazing tool. Like if you think about like this stuff here, I trust that. And I trust that's worth what I believe £20 is worth. Mm-hmm. And you'll give me something that you created or made worth that for that. Mm-hmm. That's a fucking great... How did someone convince us that this piece of paper polymer...
is worth something.
Is worth hard £20, an hour of your time or whatever. I mean, that's an amazing invention. Mm. The problem with it is it's just worth so little now. Mm. And when it's really high inflation, that gets... exaggerated. Then you have quantitative easing, mm-hmm. which is where the government print more money. If the government want to fuel the economy, if the government want to erode their own debt, they'll just pump trillions into the economy. Mm. Oversupply related to demand, reducing value. So each time the government do that without your permission, your £20 is now worth £19 or £18. And you know, you can't get a penny sweet for a penny now. I used to get 10 stingers for a quid down the tuck shop.
What's a stinger?
It's like a you know, those refresher
those long,
bars.
Yeah.
10
yeah.
stingers for a quid, or 10 packets of Tangy Toms for a quid. Now you probably can get one or two. So you can see what's happened to prices. So cash isn't dead, and I still need it. Mm-hmm. I still need it to pay my bills, my direct debits, but I have minimal amount of money that I can plausibly have in cash. Mm-hmm. So for me, because I've got companies and assets, I probably have minimum about £3 million in cash. Mm-hmm. But that's got to pay payroll for 137 people. And, you know, that's got to cover all my overheads. But if that was me as an individual and my running costs were £2,000 a month, I'd probably have £2,500 a month in cash. And that
and
would be it.
Everything else.
And then everything else in real estate, everything else in... I like the stock market, actually. Mm-hmm. Well diversified into the stock market because it's been proven over time. Mm-hmm. I like physical assets. Mm-hmm. So, you know, people say, oh, materialism is really bad. Well, if there's a revolution and inflation is really high and cash is worth nothing, you're going to be pleased you've got gold. Mm. You're going to be pleased you've got Rolex Daytonas, diamonds, rings, because that's the only thing that's going to be worth anything. Mm. So I'm not a minimalist anti-materialist. I actually think material assets, hard assets, are much better than money. So I'm storing quite a lot in Rolex Daytonas and gold and other physical things. Mm-hmm. Because like if I said to you in 3 years, there's going to be a run on all the banks and they're going to be rioting outside 10 Downing Street. And, you know, you probably wouldn't believe it. Mm. But if you look every 50 or 100 years, it happens. Mm. I mean, do you remember Northern Rock 2008 when everyone was queuing and the banks just shut the doors.
Yeah.
You know, you think people are naive, right? And I get why, because you're conditioned by society. But if you give your money to the banks, mm-hmm. you don't fucking own that money. Mm. Like, whatever money you've got in the bank.
I've got money in the bank.
Yeah, exactly. You've got money in the bank.
As you're saying that, I'm like, mate,
so
I've got some gas.
There's a disaster in the economy. Yeah. There's hyperinflation. Yeah. It's all over the media. Everyone runs to the bank to get their money. The bank shut the doors. You lost your fucking money. I mean, it happened in Japan recently. Mm. Now, that doesn't happen very often. Otherwise, we wouldn't trust banks and money. But, you know, some people say to me, oh, yeah, but $75,000 is guaranteed. If there's a run on the banks... Because they don't have the deposits in the bank. Mm. So, money, fiat currency money, it's going down in value a lot. But that actually pushes hard assets up because a lot of people are coming out of cash and into. So what, watches have gone mad. They'd rather buy a Richard Mille, a Patek Philippe, a Rolex than they would have 20 or 50 or 100 grand in cash. Mm. So it pushes the value of those up. And then the second part, and then we're going to move on to you.
Sorry, I was getting
I see what you've done.
But I wanted my personal insight. Yeah. I was like, that's what I want to know. Go on.
Debt. Mm-hmm. So there's two types of debt. Mm. There's good debt and bad debt.
See, so I hate debt, right? So I have...
You've been conditioned...
I've got credit, like my limits are there, but I don't use them, or I just have zero debt. And I think my mindset hates debt.
Do you have a mortgage?
Paid it off. No, that's what I'm saying. Like, I was just like, get rid. So I feel freer. I have no debts. I used to, years ago, student loan debt, all that sort of stuff. And then I shifted my mind and I cleared it. So I feel safer and more comfortable.
Is safety and comfort the enemy of greatness and growth, though?
Well, I don't know. You tell me. This is why I'm asking you. I wanted to know what you think. So I've always stayed away from it. I feel safer. It feels more like, you know, when you've got money under the sofa, I feel like, well, everything's paid off. Everything's cushy. There's no worries. However, I guess the opportunity to leverage a lot and do a lot is there if my mindset felt more comfortable with it.
Yeah. Okay. So I think what you've done is great. Mm. Get yourself in a financial position where you can pay off your properties and you're financially responsible. Mm. And that, to be honest, is stage one. Mm. So if people can't manage debt well and they're in bad debt and they've got loads of credit cards and they're paying loads of interest, stage one is get rid of your bad debt.
And I've been there years ago.
Which is why you're happy now, which is, so what you've done is great. Mm.
And it feels safe. It feels nice now. You're like, there's no worries.
There's always worries.
Not true.
Yeah. True. So I suppose it depends what worries you want. Because the worries I like are, fuck, I'm losing millions in inflation. I need to invest this money wisely. I'd rather have that kind of worry than an easier worry. Mm. So with inflation being like it is, if you've got savings, they've gone down 15% at least in the last year to 18 months, at least. Mm. So if I said to you...
No, don't say that.
if I said to you, hey, Ebony, I've got this great investment. Mm-hmm. You need 100 grand, and in a year, I'll give you back 85 grand. What do you reckon?
Well, obviously not.
Well, that's the deal with cash right now. Mm. That's the deal with savings. Mm. See, people can't see, because you can't see it.
And you're looking in and seeing numbers.
Yeah. So I wouldn't be surprised if since the pandemic, which is, you know, almost 3 years ago now, I think, I wouldn't be surprised if cash has gone down 30%. I wouldn't be surprised. Spending power.
Yeah.
30%. Mm. So your 100, so if I said to you, I've got this great deal, put 100 grand in, and in 3 years, you're going to get 70 grand back, you tell me to piss off. Turn off the line, this is bullshit. That's the deal with cash.
Yeah.
Whereas property has gone up more than 10% a year. Mm. So cash has gone down 30%, property's gone up 30%. So your 100, let's say it's just pound for pound, your 100's turned to 130 in property, and your 100's gone to 70 in cash. So actually, that's a difference of 60 grand in 100 grand. That's a difference of 60% in the return. Mm. But then when you have leverage with a mortgage, so with 100 grand, you can get a 400 grand house. That 400 grand house goes up 40, then 45, then 50. So that goes up 135. Mm-hmm. So that goes up to 535, plus your initial investment. Mm. So you're talking a lot more return. Now, here's the next thing which people do not get. I love knowing this. Mm. And yeah, you're rubbing your hands together.
I'm like, I need to get rich in this recession now.
My kids do this.
Get me some money.
Inflation erodes the value of cash, but it also erodes the value of debt.
Okay.
So, first of all, you've got to draw the line between good and bad debt. I need to make this really clear. If anyone's in bad debt, by getting debt to buy depreciating liabilities like clothes and holidays and cars, you need to stop that shit. Mm. You need to buy depreciating liabilities with money you can afford to lose, not with debt. Mm-hmm. So park that. Mm-hmm. Once you're financially secure and responsible and you're not buying cars for 10 grand that will be worth 3 grand in 3 years, and you understand that you're going to buy assets, then debt is one of your best friends. So I said 100 grand, assuming 30% over 3 years, that's turned into 130. Mm-hmm. Let's say you got a 70 grand mortgage on it. Mm-hmm. So you only actually put 30 down of the 100 grand in, but that 70 grand mortgage has also gone down relatively 30%. So it's gone down about 20%, about 20 grand. So relatively, the 70 grand mortgage is now 50 grand. Here's why. What inflation does is it increases your costs by reducing value. It's an increase in prices. Mm-hmm. So as prices increase, you get less for the same money.
Yeah.
But it does the same to debt, so it makes debt lower.
Okay. So then you're getting a win-win. So you get over time your capital appreciation, you're getting your cash flow, and
your mortgage is getting paid off by the government.
Yeah.
So in the last 12 months, the government have paid off nearly £4 million of my mortgages for me with inflation. Okay. Boris, I forgive you. Liz, I love you. Yeah.
Okay, these are the rules that people need to learn. Well, I definitely am here to learn.
So you know people get pissed off that the rich get richer.
Yeah.
Well, the rich get richer because they know the rules
of money. They're learning the rules.
They know the rules of money. Mm. So I like having about 60%. Mm. 50 to 60% mortgages. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're at 80, 90%, that's risky.
Okay.
You can't get that now, but you will at some point. That's risky because if your values go down more than that, you're in negative equity. Mm-hmm. The loans could get called in. But I mean, you've got properties with no mortgage on it. So yes, your property's going up steadily, and that's a good win.
Yeah, over time it's done.
But you're able to own less assets because basic rule
is... Yeah, you have to wait till you get another big chunk of cash to go in again.
Yeah. So basic rule, simple at the moment, is you can have about 4 times the property if you have mortgages on them. Because you can get 25%. You've got 100 grand, you've got 4 25% deposits for 4 100 grand properties, or you've got 1 100 grand property cash. So you've lost 4 times leverage, you've lost the growth of the other three, and you've lost the reduction in the mortgages because of inflation. And when you add all of that up, it's probably a 6-figure sum.
Okay, I'm getting in the game.
Yeah, but keep it 60%, stay safe.
Yeah, I like the sound of that anyway. That fits with my personality. All right. I'm going to get rich. I'm coming back to you for the next podcast. Right, I'm minted now. Where are we going? Awesome.
Right. Should we talk about cricket?
Yeah, let's talk cricket.
So, being an ex-England international superstar that you are, let's go in softly.
Okay.
The game's changing big time.
Yeah.
I used to play just for Cambridgeshire, so one of the minor counties, not a real county, but I loved cricket. I just recently interviewed Kevin Peterson, who's you know, a big deal. He said he just was a bit early because he played all formats of the game. He just wanted a bit of time to play all formats of the game. He didn't think that the game at the time was allowing that. But now there's all these different formats. How has cricket changed? How has the sport changed? How has it become more commercial? What are the upsides and downsides of the change of cricket?
Yeah, cricket's gone through a revolution, really. And I think it's driven by the consumers and time. Back in the day, people wanted to watch test matches for 5 days. They had the time. People would invest that attention span. And now people want entertainment. They want fast and furious. They want to be entertained in a shorter period of time. And so the game has been forced and it's moved, and you know, KP and Kevin Peterson talking about where the game is going, and he was at the forefront of change with the way he played, everything that's happening. But what ended up happening is India became a superpower. They launched what's called the IPL, which was T20 franchise tournament. Billions starts flooding in, and they turned it into just an incredible entertainment machine. And also the performance of India went up, which then shifted the whole world game. Players then started, who were attracted to the IPL, are now being offered ridiculous sums of money.
We're talking like 7 figures.
7 figures plus, where their county contracts...
I'm going to get my pads back out.
I saw you did a little... Yeah, you showed us some skill. I'm not sure if you're out of the game yet, but we'll work on it. We'll try. So I think we've had a bit of a destabilization of the game, where India created this whole engine, money's flowing in, players are becoming rock stars... it also meant that, let's say you're an English player like Kevin Peterson, for example, and you're knowing, well, hold on, I can go out, entertain on that stage and get paid 7 figures plus and do it in a short window. So where a lot of international players have been playing over cycles of years, you could go out there for 4, 5, 6 weeks and make more in that than you do for years. So it's created this whole exciting space. Now, I enjoy it. I have to be honest. You've heard about the 100, and if you're in the sport, there was a lot of... controversy around it. I was not
sure. Why was there controversy around the 100?
Controversy was because, one, it was a different format, so it's shorter than even 20 overs, it's short. Two, it was forced into English cricket because they wanted their own kind of IPL version, and that meant that counties, the original structure of cricket, now had to suffer losing players, going to this tournament, more cricket in the summer. It was chucked on top of a system because they couldn't find a way to make it work within the system.
Do you think the 100 was good for the game?
It's a mix. I think what it's done is brought a new audience, which cricket needed to do.
Who are the new audience?
The new, younger, right. more female, family friendly, more diverse. Cricket's audience, if you looked at it, was old white male that were in 60s plus, I think, as you look at the demographic.
And the whole of India.
Yeah, but I mean, in English audiences that was the problem. And so there's nothing wrong with that audience, but we weren't seeing the growth of, you know, if that was your business and you're looking at your customer base and it's aging and it's you're missing out on all the new trends, you would make the shift. So I understand why it made the shift. I guess the problem is now we're seeing players with burnout and all because there's so much cricket. Players are now having more, so there's actually now player freedom. They can choose to not play certain formats because they're going to take the money in IPL, they're going to go to Australia's version, the English version. And so it's destabilizing. Well, you like disruption. You got
just,
it on your...
I was just thinking, you could probably see it on my face. I was just thinking, I love it when shit gets shaken up.
Yeah.
Like in golf, there's this whole live thing going on. I'm desperately trying to get Greg Norman on. I know I'll make it happen. I love things that are shaken up. Yeah, and you get upsides and downsides. But at least everyone's fucking talking about it.
True. And it has brought in a new wave. And there is new money coming in and new sponsors and the whole thing. And I saw it, looking around the stadium, I saw younger... You've got a young family. Yeah. And say, for example, you take your... I think you've got a boy and a girl, have you? So you could take them, they can watch the boy and the girls team at the same... You know, the whole thing was set up perfectly. So it's been fun. It's caused a lot of problems. Those problems still have to be solved.
What are the problems?
Well, the problems are...
You talked about
we've
now.
We've now got four formats.
Too many. I mean, to be honest, right, the 100's not really any different from T20. I did think, as of just a few less balls.
It is a few less balls.
Come on.
Yeah. A lot of people... Look, we both grew up with cricket, but some people say, when you say this is what happened, they don't get it. They're like, that's just... The rules sound like a lot. So the 100 was designed in a way of just saying, it's just 100 balls. Watch it tick down on the score from 10 balls, you know.
Yeah.
So you just look at that and look at runs, and they've taken away all the sort of heavy stats and...
Is that to simplify it?
Simplify it.
Because people don't understand six balls in an over.
Yeah,
and all
what's an over, what's a this? So
right, yeah, I can see that.
Stripped it back.
They did it, stripped it back so far that when I started watching it, I didn't fucking understand it. I was like, how many balls are in an over? What is it, the five balls? So actually, people have... institutionalized with cricket, I can see why they would be a bit resistant.
Yeah. But based on what you said, it has disrupted. I think it is the future of where the game is going. Players, let's face it, if you're a youngster now growing up, you know, you have got the test, which is still, I love watching test cricket.
Is there an upside to just jump in? Do you think these short formats have actually improved test match cricket? Or made them more watchable?
They made them. You look at Ben Stokes. I don't know if you saw, Ben Stokes got that incredible game up at Headingley where he won it. He dotted it around for one day and then the second day just blitzed it.
Yeah.
Or recently, they call it the Baz Ball, where Brendan McCullum, the new coach who's come in, they've just got on and made it, and it's much more entertaining.
You can win a test match in 2 to 3 days now.
Yeah.
We just beat South Africa in like two and a bit days, didn't we?
We just got on with it, because we had obviously the Queen's death, and also they lost a couple of days, and it was still... So I find it personally more entertaining. The traditionalists don't. And there's this battle between...
Things change.
Yeah, but there's this battle going on. So we know which way it's going because ultimately it's being decided by the younger, newer audience and where the money's flowing.
Yeah.
And it's going that direction. So, I'm not going to lie, I wouldn't mind. I might try and make it. Maybe we should both make a comeback. Let's get in the nets, see if we can make a bit of this franchise money.
It must be great to be a cricketer now, though, to see the opportunity.
Yeah, the opportunities are crazy. And I think for the female game alone, there are now franchises that are dovetailing with all the men. So you've got in Australia the Big Bash, you've got the Women's Big Bash. There are the women's IPLs in place, the 100 here. So you can play your sport at the top of the game. You become friends with global players because you're playing. That's the other thing as well. You're playing in the changing room with the best of the best.
Yeah.
And you're learning. So you see players go and play a win to somebody and come back with a different style of play because they picked up from the Indian players or, you know, etc. So, the game is flying. Money's coming in. Cricket will never get where football is in this country. But I think products like the 100 or more awareness and marketing can kind of drive more interest in the game and get it back to closer to being a national sport.
I definitely did think, though... Mm. There was too much cricket.
Mm.
And I love cricket and I would watch it. I can sit and watch it, or I can sit and work and watch it. But you could see the fatigue in some of the players.
Mm.
Now you've got to rotate your bowlers, for example. And how do they solve that?
Look, that is...
Or do they not care?
Well, we're seeing players take breaks for mental health issues, exhaustion. Bowlers have... we've got a lot of bowlers injured at the moment. If we don't sort this, I don't know what's going to happen. And the problem is we have four formats. Everyone's trying to get there. So if you play in a 100 team, then a county team, you play for England, you're getting pulled pillar to post.
Yeah.
And some players are getting smart and just pulling themselves out of it and saying, I'm not doing that to myself, which is not great. How we solve it, the honest answer, they're trying to do this. There's been talk about a high-performance review and they're trying to work it out. It's a lot.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure where they're going. I'm glad that's not quite my job.
Right, the big question we've got to talk about is is there or has there been institutional racism in cricket?
When you phrase it with institutional racism, I guess, where do we start? I mean, I'd say we start with society. Society has had historical problems for a long time, and I think cricket's not immune. You look at the demographics of who plays our sport. My sport in cricket is private educators, usually wealthy, backgrounded people. And so I think we've had a problem of social mobility, people from different backgrounds not being able to come in. And I think that goes from white working class to black British to British South Asians, the whole works. There's a lot of people have been excluded. Now, the problem, so I first black woman to play for England, something I'm very proud of. Cheers, thank you. Did you know that? If you do, it's a cool thing.
Yeah.
But I always spent my career, which, you know, I've spoken about my experiences, looking around going, why are there not more people coming through? And the honest answer is I grew up in inner city, but there were no provisions for the sport in my environment.
So how did you break through then?
I got lucky. There was a lady called Jenny Washtrack, God rest her soul, who talent scouted me, did everything, gave me the money. When I had issues with people talking about my colour and race and all those sort of things, supported me through to stay in the game, which was quite difficult. But I got a lot of luck by having this one person. But when you look at the structure of where the money gets put into, where people look for talent in our sport, there's been a lot of challenges. And then there's a lot of players who've gone through the game and experienced things like I did, which is explicit racism. So there has been troubles. And I think a lot of that came from a lack of understanding, people coming from different worlds and maybe didn't understand people enough. And I think our game has now got to a point of realizing it has to diversify if it wants to reflect society. It's as simple as that. So, you know, there's been a lot of upheaval, as I'm sure you would have watched and the whole world watched, as cricket kind of imploded on itself to realise there are problems. You know, Black British have declined by 70% over the last 20 years as players. And when you start to hear the accounts of players, there was a lot of negative experiences in the game. There's 30% of the...
I didn't know that. Over the last 20 years?
20 years, there's been a decline.
Wow, yeah, because I used to think of people like...
Devon Malcolm. Yeah, so in the 70s and 80s.
Was it Chris Lewis?
So in the 70s, 80s, up to the 90s, there was...
Alex Tudor, wasn't there?
And then there's a fall off.
Is there a reason for that?
Yeah, my personal reason why that has happened is actually, if you look at a lot of those players came through in that West Indies, when the West Indies were amazing.
Yeah, right.
In terms of the global game, and they were... People who came to the UK maybe as kids, that generation played. So they already came here with a cricket culture.
Right.
So you had this sort of hotbed, and obviously West Indies were hot. So, you know, there was an England team that went to West Indies with five black players in it.
Yeah.
Because that was the height of, like, seeing Michael Holding at the other end, and it kind of made sense. But actually, there was never an infrastructure built into environments where I would say the lower economic classes live. So this is why I say it's not just a problem around race. I think it's more a problem around economics and socioeconomic groups. I actually think the working class kids don't get access. You played cricket, but you also said you went to a private school.
I went to a private school and we played cricket, and some of the state schools didn't play cricket. Just didn't play.
And just they don't get a chance.
Yeah.
And so then the game, I don't know if you saw Freddie Flintoff's recently done a documentary in the north in Preston, and he's taken like white working class kids and local kids from Preston and all sorts. But they just don't have access. They're not seeing cricket. They're not seeing these heroes come through. And so I think the bigger issue we have, yes, racism is one that has to be dealt with, and it's being dealt with, and it's been I've been so grateful actually that our game has had this, I would say, disruption, especially off the back of Black Lives Matter. But more importantly, I think we should look at socioeconomic groups, because I think the lower classes are not getting access to our sport, full stop.
Yeah.
And this is why I think things like the 100, actually, by it being more visible and looks more engaging, a kid might see that from all sorts of backgrounds and go, actually, that looks cool. Whereas if you turn on the TV, which I remember the first time I saw Test match cricket, and I was like, that looks crap. Like, it looked crap. Yeah. Like, it looked like pot-bellied blokes having tea. Like, I mean, that's what it looked like early days. So I think, you know, being able to see something that's visually engaging, you then look on the pictures and maybe see people that look like you, or they're representing your city, or whatever it is, I think will encourage more kids. And as long as we then put the resources into those areas, then our game will break down those bigger issues.
So do you think cricket is making progress in that area.
Yeah, look, I'm being honest.
Cricket no, just lie.
Yeah, yeah. I'm lying. Yeah. No, look, cricket was stuck in a rut. Cricket had no interest in sorting all this out before the movement around George Floyd, Azeem Rafiq. It had no interest in really getting to grips with it. It then got taken to the DCMS and it got, you know, made front page news, and cricket had a really bad reputation as a sport. So I think since then, and sometimes you talked about change earlier, and sometimes you have to be shocked into change. I think the game's been shocked into change, but I have seen a lot of investment, accelerate change. It's on everybody's agenda. So the game has to, and it's starting to diversify. Yeah.
And you mentioned Azeem Rafiq. Mm. So that was the Yorkshire situation. Just want to talk your way around what you think that was all about. How it played out.
Yeah, so look, Azeem, and I know Azeem Rafiq well, had some horrific experiences as a player around racism at the club. And, you know, he's spoken openly about it. And
that's fucking brave, isn't it?
Very brave. Look, I don't know how he did it, if I'm honest. Partly because you're going to be isolated. You know, people are not going to believe you. He stuck at what he believed for such a long time, and he got very little back from the pub at that point, which ended up causing more and more of the issue. Actually, I think if there had been a bit more harmony, maybe they would have been able to work through it without it having to blow up. You know, it then uncovered more cases within the game, and then I think the racism within cricket really sort of surfaced, and, you know, it ended up in a government inquiry. Where we are now, I mean, Yorkshire have gone through a really tough time, because they've had to, everything's been ripped up pretty much from the board, members in the club. It's been a horrific time for the club, but, you know, they're trying to make ways. They're trying to, you know, they had Lord Patel come in, and he's trying to make Yorkshire into something that is truly reflective of what they want it to be. So, you know, it's been messy for the game. There's no doubt about it. It's been hard to watch. It's been hard to watch Azeem go through what he went through. The players as well have gone through a tough time. But cricket possibly needed something that bad to make a change.
Mm. And you mentioned Andrew Flintoff before.
Yeah. I was going to say, what did you think of it all?
I don't have anywhere near the intel that you.
Yeah,
do.
But as a just a sports general fan, when all this stuff was kicking off, what did you see and what did you think?
It's very hard for what many people would deem to be a privileged white male to comment on this. I do realise the position. I've never had racism because I've only ever lived in England, and I can't even imagine what it would be like to be tormented for who you are. Because at least if it's something that is just what you do or what you said, but who you are and being, you know, abused for that, even if it's just words, words can hurt fucking bad. And I was the fattest kid in my school for 3 years, and that really hurt me. So it's difficult for a 43-year-old white male to fully understand this. As I watched it, because I don't know what's going on, if he's experienced it to a deep degree, fucking brave to come out and speak about it, and good on him. And actually, he's probably going to create change, which is going to make it better for a lot of people. Mm. What's difficult for me to see is when people like Vaughan, who I loved watching, great cricketer, and I like his commentary, then there's all the, did Vaughan say this, didn't he? Is now a fake telling the truth or not? And that's difficult. And I don't know. I just don't know. But here's another thing. The world moves so quickly now because of basically social media and the internet. So anything you want to learn, you can learn at the speed of the download speed on the internet. Whereas 200 years ago, you were raised in your little town and you didn't even know of other people who lived in other towns. And anything you wanted to learn, you had to walk to a library and go and read it. And hundreds of years before that, like, you literally only learned from your tribe. So people don't talk about this, but I strongly think this. So what's happened over time is the information exchange of what we've learned has sped up and sped up and sped up and sped up. And now it's at the speed of light. But we can't evolve as human beings as quick as that. So our evolution compared to the speed of information is so slow. And what I do see sometimes is people are being judged in today's world for things that were different 30 and 40 and 50 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I'm definitely not saying that is about racism, mm-hmm. but you know, my dad is a Yorkshireman. Mm-hmm. I know the culture of Yorkshire. Mm-hmm. And so in that regard, it's no real surprise. Mm-hmm. If anyone knows a Yorkshireman, mm-hmm. they know, but that's how they were. Mm-hmm. But life has moved on so quickly and we learn about everything and human beings and equality and everything else, yet Yorkshire is still like Yorkshire was. And I find that really confusing because it's hard to change as quick as we need to change. And maybe that's why the speed at which Yorkshire, it all sort of opened up was slow. Mm. I think the world is a much better place mm-hmm. when there's diversity. Mm-hmm. I always loved diversity at school because I was the fat kid. I always was attracted to the other people who were different. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. So, you know, there was two or three Chinese kids that would come over from Macau or wherever, and, you know, mm-hmm. they were a bit, and I'd always hang out with them and be friends with them. So in this weird way, I've experienced it in my own way as I was a fat kid. But I'm no expert and you're in the game. So that's just a really lay person's point of view. Mm. I do think in any industry, you want to see a bit of everyone and a bit of everything, yeah. and you want to see a bit of healthy competition. Mm. But one thing I will also say, which might not be popular, is like the world rewards people who are fucking good and fucking useful. Mm. So all we can do as an individual is focus on getting really fucking good and really fucking useful. Mm. And often it's easy for people to say, oh, well, it's not fair for me and haven't been given opportunity and blah, blah, blah. Get fucking good, get fucking useful. And you will rise to the top, regardless of age, race, sex, or anything else.
Semi-agree, semi-disagree.
Well, hit me with the disagree, because by the way, I'm also open to learning about this.
I think you're right. And talk about social mobility. I grew up...
What does that actually mean,
social mobility, I should say. How easy is it for you in society to change your economic circumstances? So if you start as a working class, can you end up middle class or upper class? Can you move through society now? We are not.
Well, you can if you've got the internet and you've got access to information. Because I have to hold that belief, don't I?
Yeah.
I teach people how to start businesses and build wealth.
You have to.
And if I say, oh, well, but the thing is, if you're in this social class or this environment.
Let me throw one more bit about you. So I grew up, Bennett's, like we would have free school meals. I'm talking my single parent mom. You know, it was tough financially. Mm. And our environment was that. So you talk about environment and being around good people and all that. We were around a world where you talked about that early scenario of where your town might be. Our town is everybody is struggling financially. Mm. Yeah. Everybody is tight. Everything is tight. You then try and get a job and you're not necessarily, your accent can put you off from getting a job because you sound a bit rough or whatever it is. So there is no doubt for me coming from that environment, there are a lot of barriers for people in those environments. And sometimes it's easier to do things like crime because you're not getting a look in. You know, you go to the job and they judge you for how you look or how you walk or how you talk or whatever it might be. So I have no doubt that...
That's why they need to start their own business.
But this is what I was going to say,
I was a misfit at school. Yeah. Definitely not like that. Yeah, and I probably had it easier. Yeah. I'll acknowledge that. But because I was a misfit, it forced me to do something different. Because the only jobs I had were cleaning jobs. Mm. I used to clean toilets. Mm. I've had shitty jobs. Mm. And I was fucking useless at that.
But the thing is, you're missing the point, is to make that leap, your brain has to be able to see different to your environment, right? So
that's why I exist, to tell people, go educate yourself online, on podcasts, on audiobooks, on TikTok lives.
The question
is,
how do we get that flip? So I believe in this myself, and I would say I've been so fortunate to move, but I've read books since I was God knows what age about personal development or whatever to shift my mindset. My mum was very good at telling me go read, and she didn't progress financially in the way that way, but she was able to tell me go and educate yourself.
Yeah.
But my point is, making that leap is quite hard when you're in that world.
Yeah.
And so therefore I understand why some people aren't able to make that shift, and I don't judge them for it.
No, I don't.
But what I would say is, my life shifted once my cricket gave me the recognition of World Cup winner. Like, everything changed, the way people talk to me, the same people who would like hardly look at you before.
Yeah.
It's like treating you like, and I was like, what's going on here? 10 years ago, 5 years ago, you didn't want to know me.
Yeah.
And now, because there's a bit of success attached, I've seen a shift in people. So I do believe in, if you can build a reputation for yourself and credibility,
get good at something.
That really can allow you to then open up some of the opportunities in the life. But my point about mindset, and I believe in this myself, is it is hard for some people and for some environments, especially when everything is set against you, to make that.
And I agree with that. Mm. And I understand it in a very small way and could no way understand it when people are raised in really underprivileged backgrounds and societies. And so, you know, I try and make sure I'm a bit in touch with that. The thing is that my message is you cannot change where you were born, but you can change tomorrow. And I think what you're saying is, yeah, but someone needs to work out how they can change tomorrow. And I'm saying, well, someone like me will help you change tomorrow. But because even though your circumstances might be bad around you, you don't have to make that mean that you're a victim. Because a lot of people use it as their story, don't they? And it's because of their working class or their underprivileged background. I mean, Oprah Winfrey was abused and she used it. So I guess what I think in a way it's good that I'm a little bit of a further step removed. So I can say, if you've got the internet and you know how to download a podcast and you know how to watch a YouTube video and you know how to watch a TikTok live, like all of this, go educate yourself and learn about money and learn about business and learn about entrepreneurship and learn about social media. Because I think Bill Gates said this, and I know privileged white male, but Bill Gates said, it's not your fault if you're born poor, but it is your fault if you die poor. And I would say caveat, if you have access to information. And in Africa, they don't often. And so that's really fucking hard. But even if you're in a background poor area where you haven't got an internet connection, go in a place like this and nick it. If you're going to nick anything, nick internet connection. Books.
Get some information. Yeah. I hear you.
That would be my message.
All right. Awesome.
And what do you think about that?
Yeah.
Was there anything else I said that you didn't agree with or you wanted to challenge or educate?
No. I think you're 100% right. I think mindset is everything. What I'm aware, and I've worked with young people, I have a charity that works with young people from tough background. I've done a lot of work with. It's the flick. And I think if you're able, you said it earlier about when you want change. I think if you could bottle how you create that moment to force somebody to get to, whether it's desperation or excitement, something is either so exciting you want that new life or that goal or dream, or you get so desperate or exhausted or can't live without that you make that change. If you could bottle how to make change, I think we'd be able to do so much more with people. It's getting people to the point they're ready for change. I think I grew up and wanted change to a certain extent, but mine was actually when I had a back injury and I couldn't walk for a year, and that shifted everything, and I had to download so many books just to get my brain out of depression and get back to playing sport. And that's mostly the flick for me that made me want everything. I wrote all my goals up and I did my chemistry degree, master's. You know, I just went on a charge from then. So I agree with everything you say. I just think it's quite hard, and that's from my experience, when you're in that world, to be able to have it. But people do all the time. There's so many inspirational stories of people who've come from anywhere. The other thing I was going to challenge you on, which I like to challenge people, is the title of white privileged male, when people go, I can't talk about something. I always think two things.
Well,
one,
I just did.
Exactly. But one, it's a great perspective to talk from, as in some of my best mentors have been white middle-aged guys.
I'm on the lower echelon of
I know you're in 43, you're not that old. But what I mean is, but they've understood the world, they have a good awareness. I don't like this sort of mantra at the moment that being a white male means that you can't talk about issues. Yes, you can, and get in the game and educate as much as you can about issues that maybe are outside your awareness. But some of the best people I know have a good understanding. So I always, whenever I hear that, I'm like, yes, you can talk about things, and I know that the world cancels, but actually, as long as you're educated on subjects, you can say just as much as everybody else, and there doesn't need to be this sort of limit of this box.
No, I agree with that. I think the reason I reference that is because I want to honour the fact that in certain areas it's not been as hard for me as it has for some people who've had it really hard. I think it's just a respectful thing to do. But if anyone says to me, oh, you're only successful because you're a privileged white male, I will hit them with a whole ton of stuff I've had to sacrifice and what I've done to be successful. And, you know, with respect, I do know how to make that. You know, you said it'd be good to talk about the switch change. Mm-hmm. I know how to do that because I've done it. Mm-hmm. And I'll give a couple of solutions in a minute. But I can only speak from my own vantage point. Mm-hmm. And if someone wants to listen to me, great. And if they don't, great. Yeah, I am slightly scared. I've only ever once talked about race or privilege on a podcast, and I'm 1,100 episodes in. Mm. I am slightly scared because there might be some things I don't understand. Like when it comes to business and money and you're asking me the questions, I feel really confident I know what I'm fucking talking about. Cool. In this area, I'm no expert. I'm just me. So if people are like, yeah, Rob, we just want to hear your opinion, I'll be a bit more relaxed. But I'm not an expert, and I should honour the fact that I'm not an expert, and I wouldn't want to say anything that shows a lack of knowledge. On the situation of that switch, that is something I can help people with, because I've helped millions of people with this. If you ask yourself every day, who am I and what am I supposed to do with this one life?
That's a good question.
And if you don't answer it today, you wake up tomorrow and you go, who am I and what am I supposed to do with this one life? If you ask that for a week or a month or however long, you'll either find it or you'll find something that bridges into something that finds it. So for me, is to help as many people on this planet get better financial knowledge. And I don't care whether you were a billionaire's son or daughter, or you've been born in the roughest area of the world, I'm gonna give you equal education on, you know, how you can get better financial knowledge. I have a foundation, the Rob Moore Foundation. I do free podcasts and content every day. So ask yourself every day, who am I and what am I supposed to do with this one life? That's the first thing. The next thing is find some people who you really admire, who have got results and success and experience in that area you think you want to be good at, and follow them and learn from them. Watch their videos, listen to their podcasts. And here's the good thing. Let's say someone's really underprivileged and they just haven't got any money. Well, you can get free credits on Audible. You can listen to podcasts. You can go and watch people's lives. So, you know, let's say you're in business and you want to, I don't know, follow one of the dragons or Grant Cardone or Gary Vaynerchuk or whatever. You can just go on their lives and watch. And it's all free. So there is a lower barrier now to get the startup information to get started. Because before, it might have been only for the rich, or you might have had to go to the library. And even now, if you struggle with reading and you've got dyslexia, you can listen to audiobooks and you can double the speed. So who am I? What do I want to do with my life, this one life? Follow people who've already got it. And what that's going to do then is that's going to open a few more doors and then a few more. So you know, like when you read a book and then in it, they refer to three other books. And then you go to the net, you open the door, and then you've got the whole new row of doors. And then that book's three. And before you know, you read 10 personal, you start with Think and Grow Rich and How to Win Friends and Influence People and Rich Dad, Poor Dad, and maybe my book, Money. And you read those, and then all of a sudden you're going to have another 20 and then another 200 and then another 2,000. Before you know it, there's this whole world of, wow, I didn't even know this existed. And then you're in the game.
I'm taking the notes. I'm in the game.
Andrew Flintoff, he came out recently being honest about his bulimia, didn't he? And he's transitioned greatly from cricket to have a really big second career. So talk about him and what you think.
He's quite an inspirational character, actually. I think, one, I definitely relate from the working class background in terms of, you just even look at the way he went about it and how he got into a sport, which he recently did a documentary. So I've always taken to him as a character. But equally, I think what his first documentary recently came out about and his challenges behind the scene is...
Do you mean with his bulimia?
Yeah, his bulimia is the challenges behind sport, which is to perform at the highest level. Obviously, that he was trying to maintain, you know, the image of who he was as a player, but struggling behind the scenes. And to think actually that someone like that was winning Ashes and smashing the ball around, but dealing with that behind the scenes, kind of, we talk about mindset and where the mind is, it kind of, I felt for him first of all, but also it made him go up in my estimation, because the career he's had, not just there, but what he's built into Top Gear, massive career in the media, And to have gone through challenges like that. One, he's resilient and he's got bounce back ability and he's put himself through a lot. I think the other is it, especially for males actually, it opened up talking about subjects that maybe sometimes feel a bit taboo actually for guys. I think, I'm not saying it's easy for women at all, but women were maybe a little bit more able to talk about some of the tougher stuff. I think guys have, there's been a bit more of a movement, especially around males and mental health and suicide rates and things like that, about we need to get men talking. And so I think seeing him open up and do a documentary like that really moved me. But I think the one thing that I always think when I see Andrew Flintoff is someone who's been prepared to try anything. You know, I don't know if you remember when he finished playing, he tried boxing. And I remember watching him getting hammered. He'd think, oh my God, Flintoff, what are you doing? He's thrown himself into theatre. He's thrown into... And I think almost for a big guy like that, you know, great. He's just always had this curiosity, I think, openness to try. And he's clearly got a resilience that has allowed him to now build another... There's not many cricket. You think about how many cricketers that you can think of that have gone on from one to into like a top of media and present. Mm. There's not many. And I think it's because he's got that curiosity, that openness, prepared to fail.
Yeah.
You know, I love people who don't mind failing. And even if his failure is going to be public, he'll still go, even if he's dealing with challenges. So he's up there as one of my favorite cricketers. He's a lovely guy, very warm. And I think he's inspired a lot of people. I don't know if he was up there as your favorite cricketer, but he was up there.
He's definitely in my top five.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. I think how he played the game. Mm-hmm. Let's do a little homage to Shane Warne while we're here. And he mm-hmm. said, how you play the game is as important as how good you are at the game. Mm-hmm. And cricket, which is generally regarded as a relatively slow sport, should we be nice? Mm-hmm. A relatively slow sport. You know, people like Shane Warne, Andrew Flintoff, Kevin Peterson, the way they played the game disrupted. I even said this to his face, Kev, when I interviewed him. I said, one of my all-time favourite moments where out of the blue in a test match, Kevin Peterson did a switch hit for six. Mm. And like that, people weren't doing switch hits then. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And just out of the blue bang. For six.
Yeah.
I know they can do it now, but it's like the four-minute mile. No one was running the four-minute mile. And then when you see it, now everyone can switch hit it for six. Mm. It's just like, wow, the audacity and the...
To have that.
But the kahunas, I'd sort of change my hands in forward defensive.
Yeah. I'm keep it simple. But I guess one thing I'll ask you actually is that about that disruptive mindset. So Kevin Peterson, in being that cricketer that he was, changed the game, but also it came with its problems. We talk about the 100 a minute ago, might change the game, but it comes with its problem. You don't mind being disruptive, as in different ideas, throwing things differently. Do you enjoy that mindset? Because it comes with a backlash. Do you enjoy it?
Yes. If you do what you've always done, you will get what you've always got.
Mm.
So if you're happy with what you've always got, you probably would see disruption as a bad thing.
Yeah, but then you're putting your head above the parapet. People will have more opinions,
noise. I just get really excited when things are different and things are happening and things are changing. And I want an exciting life. Mm. I want to have fun. I want to make a lot of money. I want to be very successful and I want to have a lot of fun. Mm. And I think that if things get staid and boring and repetitive, that's the opposite of that. Mm. So it's weird because there's certain challenges which are really hard. Like when the lockdown happened, we had insourcers, so physical staff in our office and outsourcers, more than 150 people on our payroll. Mm-hmm. And like almost 100 of them were in an office. We knew them and they had families. Mm-hmm. And we had, my MD, myself and my business partner had to sit in one in the little kitchen because we couldn't do it in any meeting rooms. And we had a spreadsheet. And we had to look at a load of people that we'd have to let go. We just went down everyone's name and basically went, we have to keep them, they've got to go, they've got to go. I really like them, but they've got to go. They're new, they look like a talent, but they've got to go. Mm. And like in that moment, I thought, oh, this is horrible. Mm. But I also thought, fucking hell, I can do this. Because when you're an entrepreneur, what most people can't do is that.
Mm.
They can't.
The hard
decisions.
Yeah.
And so it's a weird thing where it was like, I knew in this moment, this is going to be the hardest fucking time in business I've ever had. And it was, by the way, it was. And I also knew this is my opportunity to pull off a miracle that most people can't. And our whole industry was smashed because we were an events business, a face-to-face events business, and that was made illegal. And, you know, I was just talking to Harry in the car about how business is now, and we're right back where we were pre-pandemic. Mm-hmm. We kept nearly all of our staff in the process. All of the premises, everything else, kept looked after all the clients, gave the clients a load of free mentoring. And that was hard, but it was also an opportunity to do something different and be great. And the thing is, you don't get an opportunity that much to do something big and great. So when you do have an opportunity, you should fucking take it. But the downside of big and great is epic failure.
Yeah.
So, you know, with
which I think is quite fearful. So, okay, you take my life. Most of it has been in a really cozy career of sport. Player, you're told.
I've been, for example, I've been banging on about you should keep doing your podcast.
Yeah, I know. And we've gone up and down with it.
You would be bigger than Jesus Christ now if you kept doing your podcast the whole time.
You can mentor me. I've got him on camera saying that. He'll send me the bill, though. I know that bill will be coming.
Fair exchange.
Yeah. I'll give you cricket lessons if you hook up my podcast. But no, but you're right. But my point is, it's safe, right? So everything has been nice and juicy.
But that's the assumption that safe is good.
Oh, yeah. Fair point.
Like, are you going to look back at your life and go, oh, I really remember those safe moments.
Yeah.
When I nuzzled in my mother's bosom, you know.
Or it's so cozy.
Yeah, exactly.
With my warm milk.
Or are you going to remember the crazy shit? So Harry and I talk about this. Like, on my podcast, I've not really had too many disasters where we've interviewed a massive diva and they've just gone, oh, I'm fucking out of here. I've had a massive argument. But I say to Harry, bring those bits on because they're going to be the bits that we remember. And I'm looking forward to those bits. And we had a guest, I won't mention his name, but about a quarter of the way in, he just lost his shit and got really fucking angry with me. And like, right, this last bit we're taking out. You know, I don't want these questions. This last bit we are taking out. And he made me promise not to produce any of it. And I stuck to my word, even though that was the best content out of the rest of the fucking episode. And Harry afterwards was like, fucking hell, that was awkward. And I was like, we'll remember this episode for the next 10 years.
Yeah.
And looking back, I'm like, that was fucking great. I handled it really well, by the way.
Yeah.
I often don't give myself credit. I'm a bit of a self-beater-upper. But I sat there and navigated him and let him have his fucking diva moment. He thought he was bigger than who he actually really was. And I let him have his diva moment and carried on with grace. And we finished the episode. But that kind of crazy shit is what you remember.
Yeah.
In the last 15 years, what do I remember the most? I didn't just survive, but thrive through the lockdown. Not, you know, and the good times are good. But sometimes you're also... Like cricketers, do you really... Obviously, you love being in good form when you're seeing the ball big. But actually, when you grind out gritty 40 out of 160 balls on a really shit pitch, you probably value that the most.
Yeah.
So I think we value the things the most that are the hardest and the most challenging.
To shake it up, basically.
Yeah, that's why I like disruption.
Yeah, I can tell.
Yeah, I've got a T-shirt. So why haven't you been doing your podcast the whole time?
Yeah.
You know loads of famous people.
Yeah,
you
do.
Just like...
Yeah, well, the answer, honest answer is two reasons, actually. One, I really enjoyed doing it. You were amazing. I had some amazing guests on there, by the way, from Alistair Campbell to all sorts, you know, great people, sporting people. Then my career blew up. And what I hadn't done, which I think you're better, is I hadn't systemized the whole process. You know what I mean? With production and all that sort of stuff. So then I was a bit overwhelmed with that of, I had two choices. My brain energy's gone one way. Yeah. And don't get me wrong, you know, I've got to some amazing places in my career.
No regrets
in
no
that
tears,
sense.
Goodbye.
However, my podcast is coming back with a vengeance because actually I've basically got more mates as a result of the last 2-3 years in terms of my network.
Well, the thing is, you could have leveraged all of that,
if I was smart.
You know, popularity.
Yeah.
And all the brand deals you could have done.
Yeah. Don't worry.
You need me as your manager.
Do you want to come on it? Yeah. What's your percentage? What's your percentage?
I'll do fair exchange.
Fair exchange.
I've already made my money.
All right.
Yeah.
All right.
Just another little income stream. Multiple streams of income.
That's
important.
Yeah. I've got a few.
So you're going to relaunch it, are you?
Yeah. So
when was the last time you did an episode?
It's about a year ago. But they're still getting listened to.
Yeah, of course. I mean,
they help
still
with my speaking careers, and I've summed up a lot of ideas.
But
it's
if new
really
people
well.
Go on and they see the last episode was a year,
it's not happening.
Give it a shout out. What's it called?
The Art of Success. But I'm changing the name to Live Your Best Life. So, yeah, and I'm going to go in lots of different directions as well. Also, I think I hamstrung myself with the titles a bit too focused on success versus I wanted to go slightly wider in topics.
Yeah, but you've got, what's his name? Jake Humphrey is doing the high. Performance one,
podcast, yeah.
And he's getting great guests and doing really well.
Yeah.
So, you know. It's,
podcast it's, game still alive?
I think it is, yeah. I mean.
Video more.
Joe Rogan, just like bigger than God.
Yeah.
We do multimedia now. As you can see, we've got TikTok, we've got YouTube, we'll do shorts, audio and video. So I think multimedia, that's how it's evolved into multimedia. But podcasts, the bread and butter fundamentals of it. Yeah, and it, like you said, it's great for your speaking career, your credibility. Mm. People will take time to listen to a podcast, whereas on TikTok, they're always fucking distracted and scrolling.
Yeah.
You can listen to a podcast in a car. You can't watch a YouTube video in a car without breaking the law. So podcasts, definitely not dead. They're actually still quite young.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were talking about Joe Rogan before, and he did start at a brilliant time.
Yeah.
And he had some other notoriety with his fighting commentary that he could bring in.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just because you're not Joe Rogan, that's not a reason to start.
Mm.
If you have a passion, talk about it.
Yeah.
YouTube, podcast, TikTok, Instagram, LinkedIn.
Get
it out there.
All right, thanks, Mentor. Good to see you.
Boom, this has been loads of fun. This has been years in the making.
It has.